Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Well, good for you. You made it today. Quite the winter wonderland out there at almost the spring equinox. It was quite stunning just driving over here. Just looking around. Wow. That's the snow we were contemplating for one of our readings at Sitting with Sutras. Snow on the mountain completes the mountain. Yeah, but it's supposed to be spring soon, and underneath the snow and inside the ground there are these bulbs that have programmed into them. They will push up a stalk and buds when the weather gets to a certain temperature and bloom. They will do that. We know that. It won't be that long. So we had about 18 this morning in here. It was it was an intimate little group for the first talk. It was wonderful. So in our spring practice period that's going on right now, we are practicing or reading about the four immeasurable minds, and we're practicing with them, with planting the seeds of metta, or boundless friendliness, compassion, equanimity, and empathetic joy. So those are the seeds, and it seems appropriate that at this time, sort of very early spring where it still looks like winter, that we can do that inner cultivation of the soil of our consciousness. Recently, Tim gave a talk on the hindrances. He periodically does talks on the hindrances. And those are the states of mind that impede our clarity, our kind, compassionate mind, along with the three poisons, what is called the three poisons, which are greed and ill will or aversion or hatred and ignorance or delusion. So those are part of our nature, part of our human nature. We're sort of hardwired with those, but we're also hardwired for compassion, for cooperation, generosity, kindness. So there's a Native American story about, it comes from the indigenous peoples, I think, where a grandfather's talking to his grandson about those dual natures. And he said, it's like we have two wolves in us. And it all depends on which wolf you feed. So we're feeding the wolf, and our intention with practice period is to deepen our practice and our commitment, but also to feed the wolf of kindness, compassion, wisdom, clarity. The verse of repentance that we use in all of our initiation ceremonies, it goes something like this: greed, hate, and ignorance rise endlessly. I vow to end them. So we continually vow that. But immeasurable minds and other positive qualities like the paramitas, they're protective. They're protective factors for us. Because as we look around at the world, we see the direct results of all three of those: greed, hatred, and ignorance. We see racism, we see war, we see tribalism, right? We see the influence of those. But we also see the influence of cooperation, kindness, compassion. Anne gave a great story today in the Q&A about an incident on the bus that she witnessed, where a woman who's riding the bus in the middle of the night to go to a pharmacy to get her prescription, left her prescription on the bus and called. And while she was, it was just Anne and three bus drivers, and she heard them. One was African American, one was white, I can't remember the other one, Asian. And they just started figuring out how to respond to this. So they did. One of them got off. One of them talked to the other one on the radio and got off the bus and went to the other bus and got the prescription and brought it to the woman. So Anne was very moved by that. And that's just an example of that principle of inaction, of kindness. Kindness. So we're also cooperative. We care about our children, our grandchildren, and the grandchildren of other people. We want our world to be a safer, healthier, diverse, thriving place. Those impulses and motivations are also in us. I believe they're just as active, if not more. Not more than greed, anger, or ill will, and ignorance and all their permutations. But if we aren't aware, if we don't cultivate these qualities in us, then we can easily default to one of the lesser versions at any time. Those things come up endlessly. And because the culture is kind of, you know, moving us in that direction, right? With the huge, the capitalist system, it's kind of pushing us, you know, to competitiveness and to greed, you know, to seeing ourselves as separate. It's me over here and my stuff, what I need, and you're over there. So we have to work, we have to swim upstream, just like Zen practice, we often say. It's countercultural. We have to go counter to that. And so there's these practices we can engage in that help us to go counter to that. The Theravadin insight traditions offer us these cultivations of the Brahma Viharas and the immeasurable minds. The Vajrayana traditions offer us Lojong slogans and Tonglen practice, giving and receiving. Giving and receiving. So we can practice thinking of ourselves in a bigger picture, in an interdependent world of giving and receiving that's circulating constantly. So we can stay out of that, I'm here, and it's me against the world kind of feeling that people sometimes get. So these are practices we can do informally and formally as a way of seeding our storehouse consciousness with these wholesome dharmas. And one of those is called just noticing and bringing in the good. So me noticing that my neighborhood is a peaceful place and people are in generally mostly very cooperative. They're involved in a lot of really good things for the neighborhood. When I read my community newspaper, it gives me more hope than when I read the national news, because it's in our community newspapers that we hear about the good stuff that people are doing to make the community a better place. So that is an informal way of paying attention to the good. And I know we have issues with the word good sometimes because it brings up its opposite, evil, good and evil, good, bad, right, wrong. And we work in Zen at loosening the mind of preference and the mind of dualistic thinking, stepping out of that consciously at times and just experiencing our oneness. But I think it's just a word that means wholesome. So Thich Nhat Hanh, he worked devotedly his entire career to promote practices that will help Western Dharma students to do the emotional healing that he saw that they need, and teaching them relational practices, and to understand more fully our interdependence, seeing how individualistic we are, seeing how perhaps with the hippies, how self-indulgent, you know. So he gave these practices as well as practices of renunciation. And one of the ways that, one of the things he recommends is to be careful about consumption. And there's the usual ways of being careful about consumption, like not consuming intoxicants, not consuming foods that are, that have toxic effects, not over consuming. But also, he talked a lot about consuming media, you know, consuming through the internet, through books, through movies, you know, taking in junk or the violent themes, you know, things that don't promote wholesome dharmas in our mind. Thich Nhat Hanh came here in the 80s, I think it was, and Kanagiri was very impressed with him, just the way he carried his dharma, his demeanor, you know, his gentleness and his strength. I've heard people talk about Thich Nhat Hanh like he's like a gentle tank, a very, you know, strong and morally strong, ethically strong, heart-centered strong individual. I once, when I was in priest training with Tim, I confessed to an older Dharma brother, friend of mine, that I like to indulge in reading murder mysteries. And he said, oh, it's like my little secret, you know. And he said, well, everyone has something, you know. Like, forget about it. Don't worry about it. And I think I did feel better getting that response. But I'll tell you, I stopped reading murder mysteries. It's not so much because they're focused on murder and then solving the murder. Mostly it's about solving the murder, but it's because the characters are so unnuanced often, you know. They don't have an interesting vision or a moral, ethical stance, usually, you know. And that, I find that boring now. So back to bringing in the good. A lot of recent studies are being done on the pro-social and elevating effects of altruism, kindness, compassion. Kind of confirming what the Buddhists have known for many years. The Dalai Lama stresses those practices. I told the story in the earlier talk about the, I have this book, I've had it for a month, from the library, and because they keep renewing it automatically for me, it's been great. I haven't had to buy it. It's called The Book of Joy, Conversations Between Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama. And it just follows them, you know, on at a time when they got together most recently and spent time together and did forums together and talked about wide-ranging subjects like suffering in the world, within people, and their takes on these qualities of empathetic joy, kindness. At one point, the narrator is conveying to us that they're talking about emotion that comes up, negative emotion like anger, you know, or jealousy, and Archbishop Tutu's, his take was, well, once they've risen, there isn't anything we can do. That's just, you know, that's just what happens. They're there. But the Dalai Lama disagreed with him. He said, but before expressing his disagreement, he affirmed their friendship. My dear friend, he put his hand on the Archbishop's hand warmly. And then he expressed that in the Buddha Dharma and in his experience, we can do practice to prevent the arising of the poisons and the hindrances, and we can do practices that directly address those in us when they arise. So it was a little different, but it was really sweet the way their friendship was depicted, how respectful and how warm and kind. So I like this quote by William James, one of my favorite quotes. I just want to say Zen, they've been doing studies of Zen meditators too, and finding that people who practice Zen can more quickly reset from stressful circumstances. They can bring themselves back to a place of balance. We can do it, right? We do it. So the quote by William James is, the ability to voluntarily bring back a wandering attention is the very root of judgment, character, and will. So, feeding the wolf of the awakened and interactional qualities in us through regular sitting practice, meditation, and cultivating the good, noticing the good, bringing in the good, are keys to developing clarity, ethics, samadhi, and wisdom. So I want to share with you now a little practice, a guided practice for bringing in the good and noticing and appreciating it. Okay, would you like to do that? So, let's find a comfortable position. If you're not already in one, take a minute to settle in. You can close your eyes or you can have them open in the same way, partway open as when you're doing zazen, partway closed. Just turn your light inward for a moment. And begin to listen to the life of your mind with its waves of thoughts and images. Notice the tone of the thoughts, those that are lovely and those that are flavored with discontentment. And bring a question into the quiet. What in this moment is lacking? What is being asked of me for contentment to be present? Gratitude inclines our hearts to joy. And as Martin Luther King once said, whether we realize it or not, each of us lives life in the red. We are everlasting debtors to unknown women and men. It helps to pause and remember that our life is the gift of many beings, plant, animal, mineral, and human beings. We can offer ourselves gratitude for the many ways we reach out in kindness and generosity. We can notice the acts of goodwill, however small. Take a moment to recall a recent act of goodwill on your part. Sitting, remembering the many people who've been generous to us in this life, visualizing them in this moment, recalling the many blessings of our life, appreciating our measure of health, our measure of wealth, appreciating the stark beauty of the world this day, and anticipating the world of color and fragrance to come in the months ahead. Okay. So, practices such as these are not just icing on the meditation cake. Kind of looks like a meditation cake out there today. A snow cake. Right on the landing, when you look out, it's like icing. Instead, they're focused exercises to incline our hearts and minds to better swim upstream against the flow, the river of negativity, and also counter that negativity bias in our brains that we've learned about recently. Right? You've heard of that. That our brains are somehow, they somehow work to stick to negative experiences more than to positive. With the positive, we sort of sweep them, you know, under the rug. It's sort of like we expect them, like we deserve them or something. And so we don't appreciate them as much as we could. But appreciating them is what counters this negativity bias. And it seeds the mind for, prepares the mind for these qualities we want to develop, like the immeasurable minds. You can see that negativity bias in the way we get hooked on the news and the way the news functions. Even the weather, right? Oh, look out. It's going to snow so much you're not going to be able to get out. Better get some supplies and hunker down. Well, look, you got out. You got here and yesterday it rained. The catastrophizing over everything, even weather. And the news that you don't need to hear about depravity, you know, acts of violence in individuals' lives who live somewhere else in the state or far away, you know. All these things that are put out constantly because of our, we have an appetite for them, we get hooked on them because of this negativity bias. So we have to, you know, counter that with encouraging ourselves. Katagiri Roshi used to say, on one hand, on one day, there's no sweet candy in Zen. And on another day, pat your head, encouraging us to encourage ourselves to the practice that we're doing, to creating that. So I think that there's people, and including people in the practice period, maybe a few who struggle with doing practices like this, both because they use phrases, you know, that seem busy, that appears busy to them at first, like that's clogging up my mind with all these words, and also because it may seem, with, you know, to counter the teachings of no self, no self, emptiness. There's no self, no emptiness. Why are we doing these practices that seem to reify a self? Well, we are a self. You might say we're particles and waves and we're a process, but we are also a personality, person living in the world. And we're not completely alone. We're interacting all the time. Our thoughts, our energy that we put out is all rippling out to all beings, but especially the beings we interact with the most, right? So it can seem like these practices, like it's some kind of fantasy or ego trip or something. But they're not. They're actually a technology that's been developed over a long period of time. They predate Buddhism, actually, the immeasurable minds. They're found in the Upanishads. And that's what I know about, that they're found in there. So I don't think that's the case. I think it's important to counter that tendency to not include ourselves in generating kindness, compassion. So bringing in the good is doing what we did just now in the exercise. It's noticing the good and helpful things that we do and generating metta for ourselves. And it can counter burnout and resentment. A lot of Zen practitioners are doers. They're not just into sitting on a cushion, but into doing stuff, you know, contributing to the Sangha, building things, building the organization, all kinds of ways. And countering, thankfully, due to social justice efforts, the tough stuff that's in the world. And that's important, and it's needed by our world, and it's needed by our communities. But the shadow side to that generosity, and caring and passionate engagement is the potential to do too much, say yes to everything. That was me. I used to say yes to everything. Well, it seemed like everything. It was obviously not everything. But to any request that was made of me, you know. And this is over many years of serving, you know, volunteering in different sanghas. And so I have personal experience with this. There's always the possibility of getting burned out, feeling overburdened, and feeling some resentment at the other people for not doing things. So that's completely counter to what we want to do with our practice. So maybe a balance to that would be to do more self-compassion. Do more contemplation, do more just sitting and taking care of the body, etc. So people who are wired to work on social justice issues, or maybe they're not wired, but they've chosen that, they've made a conscious decision to do that, could put themselves in the circle of their own care. We can do that. And on the other side of the equation, people who focus solely on self-development in spiritual practice could use, you know, they're kind of missing out on the opportunity to practice the bodhisattva vow off the cushion, and to experience interdependence in new ways and the joy of working together with other people on important things. So, you know, find our balance. It's good to find our balance. We need the activist mode, and we need the contemplative mode, both. And we need the earth itself to sustain us. So to be more activist and less contemplative risks burnout, depression and anger and resentment. The Insight Dharma teacher, Larry Yang, who by the way, wrote a recommendation on Ben's new book, I noticed, in this latest issue of Buddha Dharma, he shares what he calls an ancillary blessing that he keeps in mind when he's generating metta in his practice and spreading it outward and unbounded over the entire world. And here's this ancillary blessing. May I be loving, open, and aware in this moment. If I cannot be loving, open, and aware in this moment, may I be kind. If I cannot be kind, may I be non-judgmental. If I cannot be non-judgmental, may I not cause harm. If I cannot not cause harm, may I cause the least harm possible. That's pretty good, isn't it? Two people asked me to send them that after the morning talk. And he follows that by saying, thus, even in my imperfections, even in my failures, I can still incline my heart toward freedom. Because we will feel like failures, right? And we do have imperfections. And sometimes we have moments of perfect enlightenment, and other times we feel very unenlightened. I think he speaks to the doubt and the confusion, too, with this ancillary blessing that he holds that might be hidden in our difficulties with practicing these kinds of supplemental practices to Zazen, like the immeasurable minds or Tonglen. Tonglen involves taking in the distress and suffering of another and visualizing yourself taking it in, that is, and even seeing it as sort of a dark, cloudy, smoky texture, and then breathing out well-being, breathing out metta, kindness. And I think that's challenging for some people. They really can't. It's also counterintuitive, but I practiced it for at least 2 years. I practiced it with Byakran Judith Regeer, who led a group that met twice a month, and we listened to Pema Chodron's talks on Tonglen, and we practiced it, and we discussed it, so we really worked with it. And, it was great for me, and it also gave me something to do when there's nothing to do for someone suffering, when there's nothing that we can do practically, and when we can't make it go away. So taking in the good through generating metta to the self. Metta is translated as either boundless friendliness or loving kindness. And the teachers that I learned it from emphasize boundless friendliness rather than loving kindness. And I find that helpful because we don't always, just as Larry Yang speaks to this, we don't always feel loving or love. But we can be friendly. We can work on sort of a non-discriminating, general, friendly state of mind. I have a close friend who, he doesn't practice these, he doesn't cultivate them formally, but he reads about them and he listens to a lot of talks online, and he's been working in a non-profit job for years now, and he has the difficult person, don't we all, in his workplace. And and by the way, they say when working with a difficult person, that person should be mildly irritating or difficult, not like the person that hurts you the most in life. You know, don't work with that person to start. Anyway, he just talked about how much it helped him to think about and contemplate that practice of boundless friendliness in terms of working with someone who regularly, who's very challenging, you know. So his ancillary blessing, it speaks to these contradictions and paradoxes in awakening and non-awakening and everything in between, which is where we live most of the time, in between. It implies a need for self-forgiveness, ongoing, and forgiving others, and bringing in and appreciating the good all along the way. I think it also helps us address this feeling of, like, loftiness of doing some of these practices, you know? Like, they're lofty or they're very flowery somehow. Others in our group have struggled a bit with the wording of the phrases, and all the teachers say, make the phrases your own. So if "may I be filled with love and kindness" doesn't work for you, you could say, "may I be at ease." "May I be happy in my body." "May I be happy in my mind." "May I be safe." "May I be free from suffering." I did the practice for a month for myself a couple years ago on the advice of one of these teachers. This one was John Peacock of the Bodhi Institute, and he's a contemporary of Christina Feldman. And he said it was recommended to just send metta to yourself for an extended period before you add in other people. So I did that, but at the end of each time that I would practice, I would also then offer it, and may all beings, you know, may all beings be at ease, be safe, be free of suffering. It felt a little less self-focused that way. And I found that my experience with it is that it's very, the practice is real, as real as anything else, and it's quite powerful and protective. And that was tested in my life. So I want to just recommend to you to find ways informally or formally, if you like, to practice boundless friendliness, compassion, joy. And on any given day, you can set an intention for that day. And if you do your sitting in the morning, you can read your state. You can see how likely it is that you'll... It may be that your intention will be just to do no harm, just not to add anything, any harm. Some days, that might be the best we can do. So I'm going to end today with a poem by... he's an Irish poet. Should have written it down. Oh, Galway. Galway Kinnell, or Kinnell. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's an Irish name. It's called "The Bud Stands for All Things." The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing, though sometimes it's necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on the brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely, until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. So I offer that to you. You know, if you're lucky, maybe you'll get a blessing from someone else, but you can always bless yourself. You can always appreciate yourself. That's being a grown up, right? Okay, well, thanks for listening. Thanks for coming out and doing this dance of interdependence here. Anyone have any comments? John?
Something I think about a lot, I think fits in with your talk today. I think all of us have, at our core, kindness, generosity, respect, love for one another. And it shows up where, let's say you're walking down the sidewalk and someone in front of you trips. You don't have time to tap into judgments you might have about that person because they might be of a different race or some. You just instinctively react and would go to help that person up off of the sidewalk. So, for instance, I think I know Donald Trump or Mitch McConnell because of what I see or hear on the news, but I don't really know Donald Trump or Mitch McConnell. If they were walking out on the sidewalk out here and slipped on the ice in front of me, I would instinctively go to them, help them up, and I'm sure they would thank me. And I wouldn't have time to, you know, tap into all my judgments about them. I would just react, and they would react in kindness. Now, the sad part is, of course, 2, 3, 4 days later, I would hear something on the news, and all my judgments would kick in. So I think even, for instance, the most hardcore racist person, if they were walking on the sidewalk out here in a person that they consider the other were walking in front of them and slip, they would instinctively, without thinking, just go and help that person. And, you know, if we could somehow stay in that mode rather than usually reacting out of all the perceptions and judgments that we have concluded that we think we know about that person.
Right, yeah, I agree. Thanks. It's true. Yeah, and that's why I'm often uncomfortable by some of the more unkind kinds of comments and jokes about our leaders, political leaders, just because I wince at that. I wince at you know, putting a lot of negative judgments onto any human being. So I just don't comment. I stay out of those types of things because they don't help me. They don't help us, you know. It's one thing to know about actions that are being carried out. We need to know. We can't be in denial about what's happening that may be harmful. But, you know, to throw harm at harm, hatred never ceases by hatred. I wince. It's painful. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else? Oh, Katie.
Being in practice period, I've been trying to look for opportunities for better practice. So I was at the mall yesterday and thought, oh, here's an excellent opportunity. I don't like crowds. I tend to have a lot of sort of judgments and separation when I'm at the mall. So I tried to very consciously send loving thoughts to people. And at first it was kind of overwhelming and very difficult.
At the mall.
After a while, it got much easier and it made me much more comfortable to be in the crowd.
Yeah, that's a great example of how to practice with it.
Yeah.
Oh. And wow, you bit off a big one, the mall? Do you mean the big mall of America? Oh, wow. Well, is that about it today, do you think? Probably for comments, questions. Okay, great. Thanks.